Hi, I'm Matt Payne, and welcome to 20th Century Revolutions. Episode 1.11, The Eastern Question. The year 1839 was a major turning point in the Ottoman Empire. As we saw last week, this year saw the death of Sultan Mahmud, who was the first sultan to achieve real success in beginning to modernize the Ottoman Empire. Then, as Mahmud was breathing his last breath, hostilities recommenced between the Sublime Porte and Muhammad Ali of Egypt, and this war between the Egyptians and the Ottomans would lead to the establishment of Egypt and the Sudan as a de facto independent state under the newly established dynasty of Muhammad Ali. And this war led to yet another intervention on the part of the great powers, as Great Britain and Russia bailed out the young Sultan Abdulmajid and ensured that the new leader would not be overthrown by the insurgent Muhammad Ali. This European intervention, which came about as a result of the string of defeats that the Ottomans faced at the hands of Muhammad Ali and his son Ibrahim, brought to a vigorous boil a process that had been gradually bubbling under the surface for many decades. Because, as we saw way back in the Serbian Revolution, the Russians, and to a lesser extent the Austrians, had been meddling in Ottoman internal affairs for a long time, as the Russians and Austrians were both instrumental in helping the Serbs to achieve their autonomy as a principality. Then, during our series on the Greek Revolution, we saw how the combined navies of Great Britain, France, and Russia basically saved the Greeks from imminent defeat at Navarino. And then the Russians ultimately secured the full independence of the Greeks after their successful war against the Ottomans. So, throughout the first half of the 19th century, the great powers of Europe had become increasingly involved in Ottoman affairs. But a subtle yet major shift then came about with the rise of Muhammad Ali. Because with his rise, the imminent collapse of the Ottoman Empire suddenly became a real possibility and was no longer some far-off hypothetical. Muhammad Ali had been poised to march on Constantinople, and he even threatened to depose the Sultan. This is not your everyday rebellious pasha gaining regional power. Muhammad Ali very nearly toppled the entire empire. But once Ottoman collapse was actually on the table, the European powers suddenly realized that they all, each for their own reasons, did not really want the Ottoman Empire to just dissolve, at least not yet. Once the European powers had saved the Ottomans from this imminent demise, the collapse of the Ottoman Empire became a central focus of high diplomatic intrigue within the governments of all the major European powers, specifically Great Britain, France, Russia, Prussia, and Austria. And this interest of the European powers in the fate of the declining Ottoman Empire is what would come to be called the Eastern Question. And ultimately, the Eastern Question will drive the course of world events straight into World War I. As we will see, the alignment of the great powers heading into the 20th century will in large part be driven by their competing interests in the territory of the collapsing Ottoman Empire. And this fact helps explain why the assassination of an Austrian archduke at the hands of revolutionary Serbian nationalists in the Balkan city of Sarajevo could engulf the entire world in the most destructive war of all time. So, as we move towards the Great Eastern Crisis, which will be the climax of revolutionary nationalist struggles to break away from the Ottomans, and which the great powers will be heavily involved in, just keep in mind that World War is where all of this is ultimately headed, and the diplomatic settlement coming out of the Great Eastern Crisis will kind of put all the pieces in place that will propel the world towards 1914. But World War is still far off in the future, and at this point in the mid-19th century, the great powers are all busy scheming how they can each most benefit from the now clearly collapsing Ottoman Empire. And even though the Eastern Question will involve several different world powers, the real driving force behind the European meddling in Ottoman internal affairs as the empire entered the twilight of its life at the end of the 19th century was the rivalry between Great Britain and Russia. So, for some background, throughout the 19th century, both Russia and Great Britain had become increasingly involved in Central Asia. Really, since the days of Peter the Great and later Catherine the Great, the Russians had been rapidly growing their empire in all directions. And as we know all too well, a big part of this expansion came at the expense of the Ottoman Empire, as the Russians became ever more dominant in the centuries-long rivalry between the Ottomans and Russians. And then, along with conquering Ottoman lands, the Russians had also begun to pry away territory from the Persians. And then, even further to the east, they faced off against the nomadic tribes of the steppe. What all this amounted to was a dramatic expansion of the Russian Empire to the south, as they entered into the Balkans, as well as into the Caucasus region between the Black Sea and the Caspian Sea in modern Georgia and Azerbaijan, and then they also gained a ton of territory in what is today Kazakhstan in Central Asia. As the Russians were expanding to the south, the British were always keeping an eye on them because the Russians were getting a bit too close for comfort to India. At this point, British control of India had been firmly established, and the protection of India, now the crown jewel of the British Empire, was a top priority in British foreign policy. With the Russians now encroaching on Turkey and Persia and conquering Kazakhstan, they were now right on the doorstep of the Indian subcontinent. And then, during the Napoleonic Wars, Napoleon had actually approached Tsar Paul about staging a joint Russian-French invasion of British India. And while this never really got off the ground, it did lead to wild anti-Russian paranoia amongst the British. These competing interests in Central Asia led to a 19th-century rivalry between the imperialist Russians and the imperialist British that would eventually come to be known as the Great Game. Now, the Great Game is pretty fascinating, full of all sorts of intrigue and espionage with spies and con artists and just adventurers from Britain and Russia descending into these contested areas as both great powers tried to solidify their influence in Central Asia. And in many ways, the Great Game was kind of like an early Cold War because the most immediate result of these imperialist intrigues was a series of proxy wars in what is today Afghanistan, Iran, Turkmenistan, Kazakhstan, Tibet, India, and other areas of Central Asia. And while all of this is extremely important in its own right for the future course of global politics, for our immediate purposes in the Ottoman Empire, the Great Game led the British to decide that they needed to prop up and exert influence over several different governments throughout Asia in order to establish a buffer zone between the Russian advance to the south and the British imperial holdings in India. And as the Russians continued to pry territory away from the Ottomans, the Ottoman Empire essentially became one of these buffer states, as the British saw it as in their best interest to maintain the territorial integrity of a weak Ottoman Empire. This desire to halt the Russian advance into Ottoman territory was a big reason for British involvement in the Greek War of Independence and later in the Oriental Crisis surrounding the Sultan's defeat at the hands of Muhammad Ali and the Egyptians. After the Oriental Crisis of 1840, tensions between the Russians and British were temporarily eased when an agreement was reached with Muhammad Ali, in which the Pasha agreed to go on back to Egypt in exchange for international recognition of his hereditary rule in Egypt. But a sort of subtext within this international agreement surrounded access to the all-important Turkish Straits. The Turkish Straits describes the body of water connecting the Black Sea to the Aegean Sea, and includes the Bosphorus, which is the strait Constantinople sits right on top of, as well as the Sea of Marmara, and then finally the Dardanelles, also known as the Strait of Gallipoli. By the way, you can find maps of all this at 20thCenturyRevolutions.com. The Turkish Straits were, and still are, vitally important to Russia, as they are the direct connection between Russia and the Mediterranean world. Shipping that comes from Russian ports on the Black Sea must go through the Turkish Straits in order to reach the Mediterranean, and therefore to reach some of the most lucrative markets in Europe and Asia. So, during the first crisis set off by Muhammad Ali, the Russians had answered the Sultan's call for help, and part of the deal was that in exchange for Russia bailing out Sultan Mahmud, the Russians were given a guarantee that the Ottomans would close the Turkish Straits to all other foreign powers if the Russians requested them to do so. What this meant was that should Russia enter into a war with, say, Great Britain, which, as we now know, was a real possibility, Russia could ensure that no British warships could threaten their navy in the Black Sea, and Russian trade would be allowed to continue through the straits during wartime. When this agreement came to light, it made the British extremely anxious, and it was a big reason why, when the Sultan was once again under threat against Muhammad Ali just a few years later, the British would also come to the aid of the Ottomans. And during these subsequent negotiations, after the British had put down Muhammad Ali, the British were able to alter this original agreement so that the Ottomans now had the right to close the Turkish Straits to all warships during wartime, unless those warships were from countries in direct alliance with the Ottomans. The upshot of all this was that the Russians lost their exclusive access to the Straits during wartime, and then the Ottomans ostensibly regained control over the Turkish Straits. Within the politics of the Great Game, this greatly strengthened the British position at the expense of the Russians, as the Russian Navy now lost their direct access to the Mediterranean. And then, by opening up the Turkish Straits, the British essentially forced the Ottoman Empire into becoming a kind of free trade zone, and British manufactured goods began flooding into Ottoman markets. The Russians, for their part, had to kind of go along with this for the time being, so they also tried to take advantage of this opening up of trade as Russian ports on the Black Sea began to grow, with the port town of Sevastopol in Crimea becoming ever more important. This opening up of the Ottoman Empire had a kind of dual effect. Initially, it gave a much-needed boost to the Ottoman economy, and it temporarily strengthened the Ottoman position internationally, as Britain, France, and even Russia to some extent were now invested in maintaining the Ottoman Empire. But the dark side of all this, as we will see, is that the Ottomans will become ever more beholden to these Western powers, and possibly even more importantly, ever more in debt to them, especially to Great Britain and France, whose financiers will become ever more present in Constantinople, providing the Ottomans with new access to fabulous wealth, but all the while imposing ever more constrictive terms and ever higher interest rates. This new entanglement with the Western powers would lead to the rise of a new class of reformers within the Ottoman Empire. These reformers would bring about a new phase within the empire defined by efforts aimed at modernizing the empire, as well as a general turn towards the West for inspiration and guidance. This era of reform is typically termed the Tanzimat, and the changes that it brought about in the Ottoman world would, in time, be pretty dramatic. Now, I say in time because it would take some time, and many of these reforms would, especially at first, be no more than like window dressing that was in some ways just meant to appease the Sultan's European allies, with not a whole lot actually changing on the ground. But even though it would take some time for these changes to really proliferate and take hold, the reforms that the leaders of the Tanzimat would bring about were definitely real, and they definitely would change the nature of the empire, though not necessarily in the way these Ottoman leaders first envisioned. The Tanzimat officially began in 1839, shortly after the death of Sultan Mahmud II. As one of his very first actions as Sultan, the 16-year-old Abdul-Majid issued a proclamation that was called the Tanzimat Fermani, which basically just means the Edict of Reorganization, but it is also often called the Edict of the Rose House. This imperial edict promised nothing less than the complete restructuring of the Ottoman Empire, with the most important of these promised reforms being, number one, the abolition of tax farming, which was at this point like the main way that the Sublime Porte collected taxes from its provinces, but was also a major complaint within these provinces as the tax farmers had been heavily exploiting everyday people, especially amongst Christian populations, for decades. Number two was the modernization of the military by more or less continuing the work of Abdul-Majid's father, Sultan Mahmud, whom you may remember had successfully done away with the conservative Janissaries, which then allowed him to begin hiring European officers to help transform his military into a Western-style standing army. The Tanzimat Edict promised to continue this effort, but there was also an important new focus on empire-wide conscription of both Muslims and Christians. This was a major change, as Christians had previously been exempt from conscription into the imperial army. And this was also connected to the tax reforms, as Christians historically paid a much higher tax rate, specifically in exchange for being exempt from military conscription. So on the one hand, Christian populations were paying less in taxes, but on the other hand, they could now be conscripted into the imperial army. And this new nationwide conscription policy leads us to the third major area of reform, and this is the biggie. The Tanzimat Edict guaranteed the equal rights of all Ottoman citizens, regardless of their religious or ethnic group. Yes, you heard that right. The edict stated that Muslims are to be considered equal before the law with Orthodox Christians, Catholics, and Jews living within the empire. Now, this is a super-duper big deal, and frankly, it's not really going to happen, as it is going to meet major resistance not only from Muslim elites who didn't want to see their historic privileges taken away, but also from the leaders of minority ethnic groups who correctly saw this process of turning everyone into equal Ottoman citizens as taking away their historic privilege of being the anointed representative of their ethno-religious groups within the Ottoman imperial system. We have kind of avoided talking too much about the millet system because I didn't want to introduce too much all at once. But historically, the subjects of the Ottoman Empire were divided into several different millets, which are essentially just officially recognized ethno-religious groups. And these groups included Turkish Muslims, Orthodox Greeks and Bulgarians, Armenians, Assyrians, Jews, Roman Catholics, Circassian Muslims, and the list goes on. Within the millet system, each of these groups were more or less allowed to govern their own affairs, and they maintained an independent court with its own code of laws, and these laws typically were based around the religious codes of the different groups, be them Muslim, Christian, or Jewish. Now, just so there is no misunderstanding here, a major part of this system was maintaining the superiority of Muslims within the Ottoman Empire. And if a conflict arose between a Muslim and a Christian, the Ottoman imperial courts would take over. And in these courts, Christians were essentially unable to defend themselves. But nevertheless, the millets did create a sort of nation within a nation type of setup, where all of these different ethno-religious groups were able to somewhat govern their own affairs for a pretty long time. So this Tanzimat Edict promised to gradually do away with all of this. The emergent ideology behind this reform of the millets would come to be called Ottomanism. And this was basically the idea that it was essential for the Ottoman Empire to develop a single cohesive Ottoman identity amongst its subjects. And really what we're seeing here is the influence of the French Revolution, which sought to do away with feudal privileges in order to make everyone a French citizen, equal before the law. The advocates of Ottomanism, often called the Young Ottomans, were heavily inspired by these European ideas of citizenship and nationhood, and they saw the establishment of a unified Ottoman nation as an essential facet of reforming the empire so that it could keep up with the growing power of the West. The current structure of the millets was seen as a major obstacle in the establishment of a single Ottoman identity, and so the Tanzimat Edict aimed to reform the millet system. And the Young Ottomans were also directly responding here to things like the Serbian and Greek revolutions, as these reformers recognized how powerful of a force nationalism could be. And they came to the conclusion that instead of resisting it, they needed to try their best to just embrace it and form their own Ottoman national identity on their own terms. And out of Ottomanism is where you begin to get things like the iconic Fez. When Sultan Mahmud II was initially restructuring the army and civil service, he ordered his military and all civil and religious leaders to adopt the fez, and one of the main goals with this was to phase out the turban, which had long been a marker of Muslim identity and superiority. So Mahmud and other modernizers saw the turban as divisive and sought to make the fez a new unifying headpiece. The effort to proliferate the fez would lead the hat to become pretty universal, and the fez would long be identified with the Ottoman world. Sultan Abdulmajid, like his father Mahmud, would wear the fez as he sought to continue the reforms first initiated by his father. Though, as we initially said, these reforms, which centered on the modernization of the military, the equalization of citizens, and the cultural push for a single Ottoman identity, would take a long time to really set in, and there would be major resistance along the way. And as we'll see, many of these reforms would never really get off the ground, and some would never be able to be fully implemented. But with the Tanzimat Edict, the tone had been set and goals had been laid out. And over the next several decades, Ottoman policy would be defined by an effort to reform and modernize along European lines. So this was the state of things in the early 1840s. European influence in the Ottoman Empire was beginning to grow in large part due to the fact that the Sultan had been saved by the European powers from certain defeat at the hands of Muhammad Ali. And then, reformers were beginning to take a leading role in the Ottoman administration with the onset of the Tanzimat era. And as these changes set in, things were kind of quiet for a bit, or at least as quiet as things can get within the late Ottoman Empire, with like a 7 or 8 year period in which the Ottomans did not fight in any significant wars, having reached a temporary truce with Britain, France, and most importantly, Russia. Everything would be reshuffled once again, though, when the Springtime of the Peoples erupted in 1848, and continental Europe was completely engulfed in widespread nationalistic uprisings. Now, the revolutions of 1848 are super interesting, but they are kind of beyond the purview of this series because they somewhat surprisingly did not bleed into the Ottoman Empire, except for in the all-important Danubian principalities, where Romanian nationalists rose up in an effort to create a unified and independent nation of Romania, following a similar course to their fellow nationalists over in Germany and Italy. Though, much like the early efforts to unite Germany and Italy, this initial uprising to unite Romania in 1848 would eventually be put down by a joint Ottoman-Russian force. So, except for this uprising in Romania, which we will talk about more next week, 1848 was pretty quiet in Ottoman lands. But if you want to learn more about the Springtime of the Peoples, Mike Duncan dedicated an entire season to the revolutions of 1848. So go check out season 7 of his Revolutions podcast. It is a great season, and listening to it will offer you nice context not only for this episode, but for this entire season, and really for this entire show as a whole. To give you the quick and dirty rundown, though, 1848 saw the eruption of a giant revolutionary wave that cut across nearly all of continental Europe, with revolutions hitting France, Austria, Hungary, Prussia, Italy, Bavaria, and many other Central European provinces. In many ways, these revolutions were initiated by the same types of romantic revolutionary nationalists who volunteered to fight in the Greek Revolution, as the revolutions were primarily fought in an effort to establish liberal nation-states, with goals such as winning a constitution and unifying national peoples, like in Italy, Germany, and Romania. In the end, however, most of these efforts at national liberation were largely unsuccessful, with the one exception of France, where our dear friend Louis-Philippe, the old Duc d'Orléans and now King of the French, was overthrown as the Second French Republic was established. And then the other major development was that revolutionaries in Vienna managed to kick out Metternich before their revolt was eventually suppressed. So even though things would at least on the surface revert back to the status quo, the revolutions of 1848 severely disrupted the post-Napoleonic anti-revolutionary settlement of Europe, as Republicans took over in France and the conservative Metternich was now out of the picture. And then, even though the revolutions were mostly crushed, the nationalistic spirit of 1848 would very much live on, and these nationalist dreams would continue to influence events, especially in the Balkans, where a handful of revolutionaries escaping the clampdown after 1848 would find refuge. For our immediate purposes, though, one of the most significant developments of 1848 was that really the only reason why these revolutions failed was because Russia had come in and suppressed them. And in this way, Russia emerged as sort of the anti-revolutionary police upholding the interests of old conservative Europe. This would become majorly important because the Tsar began to feel that the other powers of Europe sort of owed him one, and the Russians felt that they should be allowed certain leeway in their actions due to the fact that they had just saved the European heads of state from being consumed by the nationalist mobs of 1848. This dynamic would become very important in places like the Danubian principalities, where the Russians had just put down the Romanian nationalists and had then reestablished the status quo there of Ottoman suzerainty. However, even though the Ottomans retained nominal control of the area, the Russians were recognized as the official protectors of the Orthodox Christians living in the principalities, and Russian military forces continued to occupy the area. Over the next few years, the Russians would seek to increase their hegemony over the principalities, and this would become a sore spot for the Ottomans. And so, control over the all-important Danubian principalities would once again begin to erode the extremely fragile peace between the Ottomans and the Russians. This would all come to a head a few years later when the Russians sent a huge invasion force of over 50,000 troops into the Danubian principalities in 1853. Now, the reason the Russians gave for this invasion was the Sultan's failure to properly protect Christian holy sites within Palestine. And specifically, the dispute was over the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem, which had over the years become a major pilgrimage site for Russian Orthodox Christians. For many centuries, the Sultan had acted as the protector of the Holy Lands, and this role was one of the reasons why the Christian European powers were always meddling in Ottoman affairs. And indeed, at this time, the French considered themselves to be the protectors of Roman Catholics within the Holy Lands of Palestine, while the Russians considered themselves to be the protectors of the Orthodox Christians. Now, you might think that as fellow Christians, these groups would, get along. But the Catholics and the Orthodox within Palestine actually bickered with each other possibly even more than they did with Muslims in the Holy Land. Now, I am oversimplifying here, but one of the main points of contention surrounded who had rights to the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem. By 1853, these disputes had gotten so heated that it led to a diplomatic crisis in which the French, as the protector of Catholics, and the Russians, as the protector of the Orthodox, both refused to back down, and the Ottomans, as protectors of the Holy Lands as a whole, were forced into being kind of an arbiter between them. During this standoff, the Russian Tsar issued an ultimatum to the Ottoman Sultan, demanding that the Russians be made the official protector of all Orthodox Christians, not only within the Danubian principalities, but within the entire Ottoman Empire. The Ottomans, who were feeling a bit stronger at this point now that they had secured Britain and France as allies, refused this ultimatum. In response, Russia invaded the Danubian principalities. Russia's invasion of the Danubian principalities would thereafter launch the Crimean War, which had begun with these seemingly petty disputes over religious protection rights, but which would eventually engulf nearly the entire continent of Europe in its first major great power war since the defeat of Napoleon. At first, the Russians did not think of their invasion as anything more than a small border dispute between the Tsar and the Sultan. And the Russians thought that they would, as they had done for centuries now, pluck a little more territory away from the Ottomans and just annex the Danubian principalities, a region which the Tsar felt was already essentially a Russian territory in all but name. But as we noted at the beginning of this episode, the British had now decided that maintaining the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire was vital to preventing further Russian expansion towards India. Then the French, who had originally been the ones involved in the initial Holy Lands dispute with the Russians, felt that they needed to defend their honor against the Russian bully. And finally, the Austrians, whom Russia was sure would back them up, as Russia had just saved them from being overthrown during the 1848 revolutions, declared themselves neutral in the dispute. What this all amounted to was the complete diplomatic isolation of the Russians, as all the other European powers had now come to see further Russian expansion as a major threat to the balance of power. The Russians felt deeply betrayed by all of this, as they saw themselves as the saviors of Europe, having put down not only the revolutions of 1848, but before that, having also defeated Napoleon. This led the Tsar to dig in his heels, and so the Crimean War began. And this conflict would last for over 2 years and lead to the deaths of close to 1 million soldiers. So, yes, the Crimean War was a massive and highly complex conflict, and I'm choosing not to give a play-by-play of the war here. Instead, I'm going to massively oversimplify things, and I want to mainly focus on what this war is going to mean for the future of the Ottoman Empire, and specifically how the war will go on to affect revolutionary nationalism in the Ottoman Balkans. Because the Crimean War will kind of lay a bunch of nationalist dynamite all over the Balkans, and all of this dynamite will suddenly explode in 1875, with nationalist revolutions erupting in nearly all of the Ottoman European territories in Bosnia, Herzegovina, Bulgaria, Serbia, Montenegro, Crete, and of course, the all-important Danubian principalities. But for the time being, the Crimean War seemed like a win for the Ottomans, as the joint forces of the British, French, and Ottomans would end up being too much for the Russians, and the Ottomans would score their first victory against the Russians in centuries. But this would end up being a Pyrrhic victory, to say the least, because while the Ottomans had come out on the winning side and even gained back a bit of territory from the Russians for the first time in over 100 years, the war had primarily been won due to the efforts of the British and the French. And though the British and the French would make an official commitment to maintaining the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire, as part of this deal, they made the Ottomans commit to a series of reforms that was meant to greatly expand upon the Tanzimat Edict. So, what we are seeing here is the way in which the Eastern Question and the Tanzimat reforms were deeply intertwined with each other, as Ottoman reformers were often promising their reforms specifically in order to appease Britain and France. Now, I don't want to oversell this point, because it is more complicated than that, and many Tanzimat leaders fervently believed that major reforms needed to happen for their own sake in order to save the empire and bring it into the modern world. But the influence of Britain and France was very real, and these reformers were always looking towards Western Europe, both as a source of inspiration for their modernization efforts, but also as a source of money to help pay for their reforms. And Ottoman reformers of the Tanzimat will kind of become addicted to debt as they continue to take out more and more loans to fund their modernization projects. And so the Ottoman national debt will quickly balloon to some pretty absurd proportions. The Crimean War was when the seeds for this massive indebtedness were really planted, as the Ottomans had initially taken out a giant loan to fund their war effort. Then, in the years following the Crimean War, there emerged this deadly cycle in which lenders in London and Paris were raking in huge returns from interest on Ottoman loans, while in Constantinople, Tanzimat reformers were figuring out that if they ever ran out of money, they could just, you know, take out another loan, even if this loan was taken out to simply pay off the interest on a previous loan. And so, what evolved was essentially the equivalent of like those sketchy loan shark places you see on the side of the road with signs out front like, "Your credit score doesn't matter, and we take all borrowers," and all the while they use their leverage over the borrower to impose incredibly predatory terms and enforce insane interest rates. Well, this is basically what was happening between the Ottomans and British and French bankers, except on an empire-wide scale. In the short term, what this meant was that the Western powers had major leverage and so were able to make some pretty harsh demands of the Ottomans during the peace talks that ended the Crimean War at the Congress of Paris. Like we said, on the surface, it seemed that the Congress of Paris had actually enhanced the position of the Ottomans on the world stage, because they were formally invited into the Concert of Europe, and the signers of the peace all pledged to maintain the territorial integrity of the Ottoman Empire. However, in exchange, the Ottomans were forced to make certain concessions, many of which were centered around the treatment of Christian minorities within the empire. And specifically, the Ottomans had to pledge that they would finally follow through on the promises they had made in the Tanzimat Edict of full religious and legal equality between Muslims and non-Muslims. And while many Tanzimat reformers had already been working to bring about this sort of civic equality, it was pretty clear to everyone involved that these promises were made in order to prevent further European intervention into Ottoman internal affairs. And as we know all too well, European intervention into Ottoman affairs had, ever since the Greek Revolution, become like an everyday occurrence. And the fact that the Ottomans were now only able to prevent these sorts of interventions by making major diplomatic concessions to the Western powers concerning the internal governing of their empire made the Ottoman government appear very weak indeed. And then finally, many of these promised reforms surrounding the rights of Christian populations would not be able to be properly carried out, mainly due to the increasingly ruinous financial situation. And so these largely unfulfilled promises would ironically lead to even more instability as Christian populations within the Balkans would get word of their new rights and privileges and understandably begin to feel that they were owed these reforms. But then these Christians would realize that the Ottomans were not going to be able to carry out these reforms, and that they might need to, you know, take things into their own hands, if you catch my drift. All of this is going to lay the dynamite of future revolution. Because in places such as Bulgaria, Romania, Serbia, Bosnia-Herzegovina, and even Egypt, people will start to realize that they don't really want any part of the Ottoman Empire that was clearly crumbling and that was clearly offering them very little. I mean, if the Sultan is so weak and so broke that he is having to appeal to Britain and France to save him from his own rebellious pashas and to fund all of his reforms, then what's stopping anyone from just tipping the whole thing over? And this all ultimately leads us to the Balkans, where all of this dynamite is going to be lit all at the same time. Because in the Balkans, people were starting to hear more and more about this thing called nationalism and how Italians and Germans were finally beginning to find some success over in Central Europe. And maybe the same could be done for, say, Romanians, Serbs, and Bulgarians. So next week, we will turn our attention towards the Bulgarians as we begin our deep dive into their budding revolutionary movement that will ultimately see Bulgarian revolutionaries launch a series of uprisings that will precipitate the Great Eastern Crisis, a crisis that will bring the Ottoman Empire once again to its knees and see the people of the Balkans truly embark on their struggle for national liberation.